Hello, everyone. Waiwa. Lisa Gerbov, Diwayu. Leskik, Deep Degu. Lach Wolam, Stiwil Watgu. Simsienu. Prince Rupert, Lachain, Dil Manyap, Asu. Vancouver, Samix, Musqueam, Diwil Zogu, Dis. Prince Rupert, Lachain, Diwil Zogu. My name is Lisa Gerbov. My crest is Leskik. I'm Simshan. My bloodline comes from the community of Lach Wolams, where my mother grew up. And I grew up in Prince Rupert in the Simshan territory. I live between what we call Vancouver's Samix, which means the light reflecting off the bay, but more specifically Musqueam territory. But I also live in Prince Rupert, so I'm there in the summertime, and then during the school year I live in Vancouver while I'm at UBC. And for the past year I've been the Indigenous Collective Coordinator at CITR, and we've worked really hard to produce the show Unceded Airwaves for the past 8 months. I think we've done something like 24 episodes this year with a few special podcasted segments, about five of them. We've done live remotes from the Finessa Powwow and a few other initiatives that we've done. But we'll talk a little bit more about that in a little bit. First, maybe we'll do some introductions for the rest of the collective.
Sure. Hello everyone again. Nice Josh Wolwickby. My name is Mario. I come from the house of Nice Josh. I'm Niska from my mother, as well as of European ancestry from my father's side. I've called Vancouver Musqueam territory home for the last 10 years, and I've been really honored and privileged to be on that land, living, working, studying, and learning so much. And while I'm there, I want to do my best to honor and respect the people whose land it belongs. I've worked with CITR over the last year very thoroughly, but was also involved in the previous first year just sitting in on the meetings, learning more about how the collective works so that we're able to move into the second year and build on top of that. And with this year, I've taken on the role of Youth and Elder Coordinator, as well as Segment Programmer, and On the Land Correspondent would be the technical word for what we developed. But thank you.
And my father's side and my mother's side, I'm, I guess, British and Scottish Canadian. And I joined up with the collective this past fall, just trying to get my foot in the door of radio broadcasting. I always knew it was something I wanted to do, but I did not know quite how to get started with the skills that you might require or who's allowed to be on the radio. And that was kind of a daunting prospect for me, but the fact that there was an Indigenous collective set up already made it a pretty easy transition to get in, to meet people who knew how to do radio, and to actually get on the air myself. So that is how I became involved, and I've been involved ever since. But that is me.
Hello, everyone. I am Victor Sauca. I am a Quechua indigenous person from Ecuador, South America. And I am doing my major in First Nations and Indigenous Studies at UBC, and my minor in Gender Studies. So yes, I am an Indigenous Collective member, and basically we were classmates with Lisa. And then basically she recruited me to be part of the collective. And yeah, so I am nervous, like speak in public, or also like because of my limited like communication skills. So, but anyways, I just decided to be part of the collective and trying to overcome like these limitations. Yeah, but I wasn't that active as well. Maybe I went like just 3 times and then stopped going, and it was a little bit awkward to go again. But then I was like, okay, if I don't go now, it's like I will go never. So I forced myself to go again, and then that's why I am here as well. And yeah, that's basically part of the process. So now I'm going to explain, like, give a short summary of the history of the Indigenous Collective. So basically, the Indigenous Collective started in 2015. So it came out of a need to create an indigenous space in the CITR station at UBC. So they applied for a grant. Once they got it, they hired Celia Joseph, who was the first coordinator of the program, and she started recruiting people from the campus and like from her own network. And so they basically set the groundwork and also the protocols for the collective. Basically, the format of the season was a little bit improvised, and it was more an arts-based program. But then in the second season, Lisa Girbab was hired. And so the show acquired like a more structured format, so, and it was a little bit fixed and had consistency throughout the season. So basically the structure was like we would play like a scripted intro and then introduce the hosts and then the topic and reiterate the intention of the show. And so it had also around like two 20-minute segments, and then it also incorporated like current events, indigenous issues, and also indigenous music. So one of the like the some of the benefits from like having this scripted structure and like scripted structure was that it allowed like for new members to enter or like to contribute in an easy way. Like myself, if I went there, I wouldn't be able to say anything, but it helped me a lot as well. I was like co-hosting like 3 programs and saying some stuff there that was like already written and just, yeah. And then like it was, yeah, it was also like improved our broadcasting broadcasting skills as well. And yeah, so in the intro, what we would do is like self-locate our service, like as we did now when we were introducing our service, and it also helped to build like a sort of self-confidence as a team, which was really good. And then, like, other thing that we did was that the work was distributed according to like the each member's skills. So like someone would produce some pre-recorded, interviews or some podcasts, and other members would contribute with panel discussions, and others like contributing with live interviews as well. So basically that was the second season structure, and just, that's it.
Contributed to how we ran the group this year. Last year it was kind of like a mixed bag, so every episode was structured differently. A lot of it was like conversational, so back and forth between the host and the guest. And then this year we implemented a bit more structure as far as having a scripted introduction where everyone kind of shared that role, and it was a great opportunity, as Victor said, to kind of like start in radio. You could start by helping just by reading the introduction, and then from there you could, you know, build your confidence and do more like interviews and things like that. And then we also did have it set up with the two 20-minute segments, so the show would be kind of split into two portions of it. And that really did help to distribute the work a little bit more so that more people could get involved. Since we are a collective, the way that the show is produced is we'd have volunteers, multiple volunteers. I think the most amount of people that we had on this season was about 21 people who came through the show. Maybe about 8 people who are consistently coming every semester. But with having so many people contribute to one show, we just had to make sure that we found space for everyone's voices to be heard. Do you remember how many people we had on for one episode, I think?
Yeah, we managed to fit as many people as possible into like the tiniest studio space. Maybe, I want to say also, definitely like 10-ish to maybe 12. And that was really wonderful. It was a part of a panel talk where I think Lisa maybe might know a little bit more what that day looked like.
Well, I think for our winter solstice holiday special, we had like 11 different voices on the air to talk about experiences with Christianity and Christmas and traditions and what life is like on the res and whether or not people even celebrate Christmas, that kind of thing. So, and that was an extended episode. I think we had like maybe an hour and a half or 2 hours where we talked about that. This is a photo of one of our panels that we did on the U.S. election that happened just after Trump got elected. So we had a combination of Indigenous and non-Indigenous collective members come in and discuss how they felt about the election. And not everyone in this photo was on the panel. Some people were on the panel, and then some people were helping with the intro, and so we'd all kind of switch out all between 3 microphones. So it was kind of like musical chairs, but that was kind of the way that we structured the show every week, was we would just try and get as many people on as possible. And the door was always open. If anyone was ever interested in the Indigenous Collective, we would encourage them to come to our weekly meeting, or else we'd invite them to just sit in on a show where they could just sit with us in the studio and watch how the show is produced.
Yeah, exactly. And just to add on to that, by enabling just to have people to freely be in the space with us while the show is going on, they had a chance to see what was expected or what would come up in a show, much like you had a chance yesterday to become familiar with what the tools are. If you don't know what it is, you might not know how to use it. So becoming familiar with that space, being allowed, just knowing that it's open, allowed for people's voices just to grow, and we're able to really create a cohesion and allow that to broadcast out.
I think just making like a welcoming studio space too is really beneficial, because we know we talk for like 15-20 minutes and we play a song, and within that 4-minute song we wouldn't get a whole lot done, but we would be able to joke and laugh and talk about what we just said or something we goofed up on, or we'd be like planning the next segment, and so people who are in the studio could be participating in that way, which was really cool. Yeah, so just to reiterate, Victor, it just facilitated the contribution of new collective members, developed their broadcasting skills, and it was very supportive, and it was pretty good for team building, I think. So some of the challenges. This is a photo of us broadcasting a live remote, our first live remote of the season, or I think our first and only live remote. This was from the Finessa Powwow, which is a student-organized powwow on the UBC campus that the First Nations and Indigenous Studies student organization coordinated and then partnered with the Indigenous Collective at CITR to do a live broadcast. So we did 2 hours of broadcasting from the powwow. So this was on this side, on the right-hand side, is just a note someone left on our Facebook page. They're excited to hear Gibao, which is a Tsimshian Smalayuk metal band that we played on our show. And it was cool because like we podcast all of our stuff online, But this person had messaged us before we had podcasted it, so we knew that they were listening to us live.
Could you read that quote? Sorry, it's hard to see that.
So it says, "Stoked to hear some gibao. Love the diversity of the music you all play. Keep up the good work." And that was in March. So some of the challenges that we faced as an Indigenous collective is, I mean, sometimes probably like one of the most ongoing challenges that we faced as a collective was either we would, well, for the most part, we would have usually too much content for a one-hour time slot. So we were very limited by having a one-hour time slot every week, which is not a bad problem to have. But, you know, when you have current events happening all the time and you only have 1 hour a week to talk about it from an Indigenous perspective with a group of young Indigenous broadcasters, an hour does not go very far, especially when, for us, we were talking a lot about Indigenous issues, current events, and entertainment. So any given episode could cover all three of those aspects of Indigenous broadcasting. And so just having the one-hour time slot is either, it can be too, for us it was mostly too short of a time. On the odd occasion, when we would only have like maybe one or two people in the studio, it felt like a very long time, but for the most part it wasn't enough time for us. Some of the institutional challenges, since the Indigenous Collective has only been around for two seasons now, it was very difficult for us. It was very difficult for me as the Indigenous Collective Coordinator to come in without really having a shared understanding with CITR about what Indigenous programming should look like from my perspective as a Tsimshian person. Especially because, I guess in the first season, Celia and the Indigenous Collective did a lot of really good work setting up the protocols for the collective and for unceded airwaves. It was very much on kind of like an operational content level, and so it was making sure that Indigenous voices were heard, making sure that we played Indigenous content, those kinds of things, which are all very important. But for me, what I find very interesting about making Indigenous media is a lot about the process as well, not just the outcome of the media. And so for me, what was very important for me was in recruiting volunteers, I felt that it was very important to ensure that we had a food budget for our weekly meetings. And that wasn't a big budget. I think it was like, you know, $15 a week, and it was basically just to buy carrots and hummus and bananas and just snacks to create a more welcoming space for people to come and collaborate, especially talking about Indigenous topics. And the Indigenous Collective is open to Indigenous and non-Indigenous people to come and talk about these issues. And so having food at our weekly meetings was very important in order to not only break the ice and to create that kind of communal space and shared understanding and respect for one another, but also for Indigenous students in a university setting. I find that food security is something that Indigenous students face, whether they admit it openly or not. It wasn't something that I felt that I wanted to make people feel uncomfortable for, or like, you know, say like, hey, did you eat this week? But I just wanted to make sure that there was food there so that when people knew that they were coming to the meeting, they would have food. And one of the teachings that I have learned from where I'm from is when you have food at events, our society is a feasting society. When you have food at events, as you're taking in the knowledge, as you're learning and as you're processing information, you're also eating the food. And so as you're feeding yourself and you're feeding your body, you're also feeding your mind. And so having food at these meetings was something that was very important to me culturally. And so there were instances where CITR and the management at CITR didn't understand why we were getting special treatment or why this was something that was so important to us. So having conversations and what felt like a lot of lobbying the institution of CITR within the larger institution of UBC was a task that I worked at basically all year. And now going into the third season, it's something that is going to be set out in the budget and is going to be ensured for future seasons at CITR. So that was a bit of a challenge, just trying to have that discussion between a non-Indigenous organization and an Indigenous program within that framework. And so that was one aspect of implementing Indigenous protocols. Another part of it was self-locating, as Victor said, in our programming. So every week on air, we would all self-locate. We would say who we are, where we're from, and we give the audience an indicator of where we're coming from as broadcasters. And so just implementing protocols like that was something that was a little bit challenging at first, but is something that we became more comfortable with and institutionally, like, we're now able to ensure that we have going forward in creating media for this.
Yeah. One other challenge that I found that came up was actually finding out more history about Indigenous content at CITR. It came through very nuanced ways, but finding some original tapes from the 80s, just in conversation with a stranger, yielded some really great results. And so unfortunately, that didn't happen at CITR. When I went through the archives, there was nothing that I could find. In discussing with everyone there, to date, they had only known of any Indigenous content from the year 2000 onward. And so that really gave us a bit of a challenge for kind of gaining a sense of self within that space, too, as far as, you know, what was done or implemented in that space to create those spaces for those voices, and really moving, as when we speak about the future in this conversation today, like where we would continue onward. And so some of the challenges that we had was really developing a sense of what those protocols were, like Lisa was saying.
Another protocol that we implemented for this past season and going into future seasons was ensuring that we would have a budget for giving gifts to our guests, especially when we have elders come on to our show. You know, elders are very busy, and elder fatigue is something that elders face often, especially in UBC, where they're asked to come to a lot of different events. So we had Elder Larry Grant, who's from Musqueam. He's the UBC liaison, and he's also a Hunkaminam speaker. He came on our show, I think, twice this season.
At least twice.
Yeah, for two very long segments, like 20-minute segments. And so what we did was we made sure that we gifted him at the end of the season publicly at one of our student lunches, just to show him our appreciation, not only for coming on our show, but also guiding us throughout the season. Because he's taught us a lot about what it is to be on Musqueam territory and be broadcasting, not only learning about our own languages, but also making sure that we're doing it in a respectful way.
Can I make a comment about something you said? I wanted to make a comment about funerals. I know that I saw one time on APTN the culture and religion, because you were talking about religion. That seems to be a very powerful law or something within our territories about the Catholic Church being involved whenever we have funerals. And I'm just, you know, I really question that, because it seems to be fear-based to even make a comment about religion and the Catholic Church. And I've become more open-minded to recognize all the abuse issues that have come from the church. And still people continue to honor the Catholic religion and having the priest at our funerals. And I have said to Chief and Council, where I would really like to be buried in the old-fashioned way that they used to do in church house. They made their own coffins, and I would like to be buried in where the graveyard is, because it still exists where my parents were buried, and I'd like to have them form something to where they could bring us back there. It's very costly to use the funeral, the graveyard, they discharge you. It's very costly to get your coffin. You know, all of it is a lot of money the band has to put out in order for a person, you know, to be buried properly. And in church house, we never had put out a penny, you know, for those things. People would get boards and make a coffin and wrap a person in a blanket, dress them nicely. And of course, you know, they would have the priest say a prayer, but then they would carry everybody to the graveyard, and the guys would dig up the ground and bury you. It didn't cost money, you know. So nobody ever seems to really want to open up about religion and what it's done to us, you know. And it's like a fear, and I think the fear tactic came from the residential school, how about hell and the fire and burning in hell and blasphemy, you know, if you said anything against the church. I think even now it's happening in England. I remember somebody saying that somebody was, something happened to a person that was in a higher position, I don't know, it was a pope, that went against some of the rulings of the church. That's how powerful their I don't know what you call it, the rules and regulations, I guess, that they have, you know, for the Catholic religion, that you cannot say anything, you cannot go against them. And I remember them one time even saying, if you have not been baptized, if you can't show that you have papers where you're baptized, we're not going to bury you. We're not going to be there for your funeral, and we're not going to bury you. They make those kind of comments to our people, and that's another fear tactic, you know. They have such a strong ruling around funerals, and it still exists here. I became more open-minded, and what I follow is the traditional beliefs that was been handed down to us from a lot of the elders. You know, that to believe in the Creator, there's nothing wrong with believing that there is a God, we call Him Creator, that He's kind and good. The church taught us that He was punishing, but the way that we want to believe it is that the Creator is very kind and loving and loves all of us, and that's the way I believe it. And I don't have to go to the church to tell everybody that's the way I believe it, right? This is my own personal belief now. And maybe somebody would say I'm talking blasphemy by talking that way. But all our people have already believed in nature, the water, the trees, you know, things like that. That's what I believe, that the Creator's in all things around us. And that's that. I'm comfortable with that belief. And I don't have to go to church to announce the way that I believe, you know. But I just wanted to make that comment about that, because you talked about that. At one point, you guys talked about religion. Seems to be a big no-no not to talk about religion, right? I just wanted to say that.
Thank you, Daisy.
Mm-hmm. I think I just want to finish off talking about challenges and just mentioning the limitations of the role of the Indigenous Collective Coordinator. For myself, I found that one of the challenges was that I spent a lot of my time coordinating students who are involved in the Indigenous Collective specifically. And I spent a lot of my time coordinating different aspects of the show, where CITR as an institution needed more of that. They needed more people to organize ways to decolonize the station as a whole, whereas I was more fixated on working with the Indigenous and non-Indigenous students and community members who were contributing to the radio program. And so I found that it was, while the position is very valuable, I felt like there could have been at least two more you know, people who are coordinating at that level, especially because, I expressed interest, and other people at the station expressed interest in incorporating language more institutionally, so having Musqueam broadcast in their language or doing like a word of the day. However, like in just trying to coordinate the show, I wasn't able to do that. So that was a limitation that we faced this season. And especially being asked to do a lot of different things at the station to do with Indigenous programming was pretty difficult to do all of that. So some of our successes.
Can you please read that? I can't quite read it from here.
So in the Indigenous Student Executive Volunteer position?
Just the quote.
Oh, the quote says, this was a Facebook message that we got. It said, "I would like to acknowledge how important shows like yours are to the Indigenous community. Hau'a for your time."
And as Lisa was just expressing the need for additional official positions within the station to maybe alleviate or to delegate off other roles and responsibilities, such as liaison or being a liaison between the Indigenous community in Vancouver as well as with Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish. Through much conversation and kind of developing out of what many of the collective members had collectively contributed to, we worked with CITR on developing an official position, the Indigenous Student Executive Volunteer position. Unfortunately, it's not a paid position. I think ideally that's another institutional issue for a lot of students going in. The access to some finances would go that step further in enabling a sense of security and stability in being able to execute those roles. As much like you said, for having food for the collective members, as well as maybe having a small budget to be able to, you know, bring chocolate for the group or an elder to have tea. To be able to have that time to really sit and listen in those important times when those voices want to be heard. That's what that new position is going to be. Hopefully we'll be able to secure some more finances for that in the coming years. But moving along, we've had other successes as well. We have had, youth workshops. And this is where I come in specifically. My background in my professional life outside of school has been facilitating youth workshops as well as coordinating youth programs, one specifically with the Musqueam Youth Program. And that really helped give me the background in being able to facilitate and develop a workshop for the Indigenous collective. In particular, one day we were sent an email. We were contacted from the Four Directions Aboriginal High School in the interior, just saying, "Hey, we're going to be in Vancouver on this date. What are the chances of possibly collaborating on a project together? We're a classroom that's focused on critical media. But because the youth are all Aboriginal, we want to be able to give them access to people that are in that field right now." And I guess they had heard the radio program on Seated Airwaves and were inspired enough to contact us. And automatically my reaction was yes. And of course, 10 minutes later, I was like, "Oh my God, what did I get myself into?" But, you know, when the community reaches out like that, I've learned and come to an understanding you just have to do it. You make a way to do it. And during the time when we were set to facilitate this workshop was during Hobie, which is a large celebration for the Nisga'a people, but in particular in Vancouver, brings together many Indigenous communities from across BC. So I managed to make sure I could secure some time in between that to work alongside this amazing team to hold that space for the Four Directions High School. And we had a group of about 35 students come through, and we
facilitated a workshop on Indigenous critical media. We gave them a proper station tour and the opportunity to become familiar with some of the tools at the station by recording just small excerpts, making it an easy access to being in that space and getting a chance to use their voices and hear them back. In addition to that, Angela Sterrett, a CBC journalist, was also brought in to facilitate a workshop in that same day with those youth, just creating, much like today, a media conference. When I think back to that and reflect, it touches my heart so much to be able to hold that space to inspire a future generation. And again, much like the reason why we're here today, that value of looking towards the future, inspiring the next generation. Maybe they're not going to do radio, but you can't deny the impact of where media is at today, social media, anything that those youth are interested in. And so shortly after that, that workshop was done in kind of holding more conversations with other people. We got more interest again. And so we facilitated another workshop for a smaller group of youth from a UBC youth program called CEDAR. It's a summer science-based program, but they have youth leadership that comes out of those. And so during the off season, they come out to UBC and they're looking and they're hungry for these kind of programs. So again, I was happy to just say, yes, come in, we'll do whatever we can. And because the age group was a little bit younger, we had that working model of the workshop. We tailored it specifically to their younger age, brought them in, had a chance to do all of the same fun things in the station, using those tools, getting a chance to hear themselves. And we recorded a video of that tour without the youth in it, except for one. And if we have a chance, maybe later we can watch that. It kind of gives maybe a little more visual perspective of what that experience is like. And I think lastly, I have maybe one more point to that. We've also received invitations to present to high school classes, much like our recruiting. On UBC campus, we've gone to speak to several classrooms where we were able to reach out and gain a much larger collective group. And that's where we had met Victor, who's with us here today and did such a great job in sticking with us. And so the filming the video was also part of that in developing our community outreach workshop, where we're able to give a visual perspective, because we're not able to bring them to the station, we can bring it to them. And that's what I see as our successes.
Yeah. I also put in Indigenous language programming, because for me, as a language learner, I've spent a lot of time this past semester just practicing Smalek on the air, and it was really nerve-wracking at first, but the more that you do it, the more comfortable you get, and has helped me with my pronunciation and my confidence in it. And we have a few people in the collective who are learning their Indigenous languages now, and I think the next step for us is to start doing weather checks in our languages. As Josh pointed out, that's something that we could easily learn the grammar for as like a stepping stone to learning our own languages, but also representing our where we are coming from and who we are as Indigenous people.
Looking at the successes that we've had, I think a lot of them have been about making radio accessible to Indigenous students and community members who are within the UBC campus community. And you heard about like ensuring that there's a space that's specifically for Indigenous people. The Indigenous Collective is a group that people know you can show up and that's for you. Like another thing is just having the CITR membership fee. If you talk to the coordinator, you can just get that waived. So that we're really trying to reduce the barriers and have that accessibility be institutionalized so that due to the nature of being a student, when we're gone, because of graduating or failing out maybe, you never know, that the next people who are taking the reins for the Indigenous Collective are able to just, that's just already the practice. They don't have to get in touch with us when we're trying to find work 2 years from now. Who do I talk to about getting food for our meetings? That would be great. Just getting that set in stone now. And I think building on that, one of the things that we can also begin to have set roles for, roles that must be filled for the Indigenous Collective to be considered complete, would be having community liaisons that are specifically going to meetings with community members and community organizations, because currently that is happening, but it's mostly being done on a personal level. Like the members of the collective know people in the community. My vision for going forward would be there would be a role set where you're going to meetings at the Friendship Center and you're saying, this is what the collective is doing this month. Where do you see gaps? What do you have anything you want to bring onto the air? And going to Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish with the same spirit of trying to make radio accessible to as many people as possible, and having the community connection is entrenched is pretty important. I think also building and developing on the language work that we do. Currently, it's mostly introducing ourselves in our languages, content about language revitalization, and words here and there. But there's room to build initiatives like Devin was saying earlier with her word of the day and things like that. Having an ongoing piece of programming that is completely structured around language is something that we need to build on, so that the work that we are doing isn't lost when we move on from school. I think there was another point I had on language, but I guess one of the odd things is that unlike some of the other people we've heard from today, we're just the four of us. I'm Cree. Niska, Tsimshian, and Quechua. We come from pretty, and the other members of the Indigenous Collective are very mixed, and there are a lot of different nations represented and a lot of different languages. So it's tougher to say to somebody, well, we got to have this Tahltan language piece on the air because we're not operating out of Tahltan territory, but there are people living within Vancouver and our broadcast area who that is their language. And even if it's not, it's still important to be asserting who we are on the airwaves. So I think that even if it's a little awkward, we're broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory and we don't use very much Hunkaminam currently, but in conjunction with our own languages, I think those need programming needs to be built on those options. I think there's really exciting opportunities for where to go with that. Maybe one other thing that we haven't really talked about too much, but is using. So one of our limitations is our 1 hour thing. I think the show that comes after us, I think she might hate us, because we're always running a minute behind, and she wants to start right at 11. We really need a second hour after our hour that's just called Indian time, or something like that. But I'll also, I think, because we have 21 members this past semester in the Indigenous Collective, that's a lot of people to get into one studio at one time. So I think as we are growing, the possibility of just expanding the shows from unceded airwaves to other shows that do specialize in certain things, whether it be indigenous legal traditions or like indigenous science programming. Those are things that you can't quite fit into a 20-minute segment in an hour-long show, but can be blown up into something else. And having this group of young people together just bouncing ideas off each other is really great. And there just needs to be more avenues with which we can put those out there and just, I don't know, make good radio, I suppose. Yesterday, I came over from Quadra. I went camping a little bit before coming here. So if you met me yesterday and I was like kind of smelly, that's why. But I got picked up on the way to the ferry by this older white couple, and they asked if I needed a ride anywhere on Vancouver Island. I said no, that's all right. I'm just going to be in Campbell River. And they said, oh, what are you doing? And I told them I was going to an Indigenous radio conference. And she said, turned and said to me and said, oh, I didn't know they did radio.
Those people.
And so, you know, that is sort of the mentality that we were often facing. But I think by just making radio more accessible for Indigenous potential broadcasters, we can only serve to dispel that kind of ignorance. So I think that's a big part of why I'm glad to be here today, talking to everyone here, and seeing everyone else who's been able to bring their experience to bear. Because I think, especially with some of the like the community relations stuff that I'm interested in developing for our collective, I really appreciate what you guys have put forward.
I see at the bottom of the list it says helping other First Nations media outlets. And I just, you know what, your family and your grandparents up in Attawabiska would love to hear you speak through our radio from UBC, telling them what you're doing, and any other university college of the country, because their grandparents want to know how the kids are doing in the city. And we have like what's called camp calls, where, you know, like, hey, tell my sister to bring some sugar when she comes to camp, stuff like that, you know, which is communal stuff, but like, just brought up an idea that, you know, the elders would love to hear how the grandkids are doing if they were to call in a radio station. And it's just a remote cast, right? So, well, I think we should try it. We'll have you call into the station. I'll give you my card. We'll try something else. Yeah. Yeah. We got no rules. We make the rules.
To call in while I was like, I live on Commercial Drive, Commercial on Broadway to be specific. anybody in East End, what's up? It's a very busy corner, it's a transit hub, SkyTrain bus, and lots of Native people in that community travel through that area. And so not only do we see the opportunity for holding space at the station, but also taking up space and letting people know, just getting some breathing room. Like, we called in, I would call in and say, hey, this is Mario on the land correspondent calling from the unceded territories of Broadway and Commercial Drive. and this is what the weather's like today. And, you know, kind of say it loud enough so that everyone else around would know. And like, oh, you know, I'm just on the radio. Can you guys be quiet? Like, yeah, making sure that people know that we're out here and we're making media, and it's important that our voices are getting out there. And, you know, I heard back on, because it was on social media right after that, you know, hearing back from the community, just like the sense of pride of even just a neighborhood is huge, to be able to see yourself, to be able to hear yourself, even if it's just a phone call, right? Yeah, that's what it takes, just a phone call to call your fam.
And even though we're just one radio program within the radio station, I think the community support has been phenomenal. Like, we've had the Heltsik First Nation reach out to us to send our program specifically a press release to talk about the Nathan E. Stewart that ran aground in their territory last fall. We covered it. We spoke with Jess Housty in our second episode of the season, which was a really great interview. I encourage everyone to listen to it. But they followed up with us in the spring this year to invite us to their press conference. And at that press conference, they said that the Indigenous Collective and CITR were the only people who were asking really informed and engaging questions at this press conference. And so as the Indigenous Collective, we're finding that not only are we like a niche program, but we're also fulfilling a need that is out there for Indigenous communities. And so also with helping other First Nations media outlets, we interviewed a couple guys from Jason Camp and the Posers, which is a Haida punk band out of Skidigit. And so when we had them on the radio station, they mentioned that they were starting up their own community radio station out of Skidigit called the Haida Gwaii Radio Society. And so in talking to them, they didn't have any resources set up. They didn't really know what was involved in running a radio station. And at the moment, they're running an internet radio station with the slogan Radio Occasionally, because it, in a 24-hour clock, when you have about 7 volunteers, you can't fill up the full clock. So they're on, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 nights a week. But just in conversation with them, they needed resources. And so what I was able to do was to help share some resources from CITR to help them get set up with coordinating volunteers, doing production training, that kind of thing. And then also in the future, I think we're going to try and develop kind of like a best practices manual, something that's easy and comprehensible for people to read and look at going forward. Because like I went to broadcasting school and I learned how to make radio in a very specific way. It was a very Western way of making radio. It was, you know, you go in, you don't give people the questions in advance. You try and get them to say things that they wouldn't, that they would censor themselves from saying, you know, try and get the full story and be unbiased and things like that. Whereas in thinking about an Indigenous methodology and thinking about systems of oppression that have misrepresented Indigenous people since the creation of media, that wasn't something that our show was trying to replicate. And so our practices are very different from what I learned at BCIT. And so providing questions in advance so people can prepare for how they would like to be represented in the, on the radio. You know, giving people the opportunity to rescind anything that they might have said that they didn't want to have go out publicly. Giving people the opportunity to listen to the interview before it goes to air. Is something that we offer, but not a lot of people take up because they trust us. But if it's a very touchy subject, you know, some people do want to hear it before it goes to air. And so we offer those types of opportunities for our interview subjects, which just, it helps them feel more comfortable with us, but it also helps them with their own self-representation on the air, which is something that not a lot of media outlets do. And so this quote we just got last night. Somebody posted about Canada 150, and it was an Idle No More post. And somebody had tagged us asking if there was an unceded airwave show about it. And so we replied saying, yeah, episode 8 or something like that. We talked about it. We played the George Erasmus clip from, like, the, I think it was 1990 for Canada 125. And so when I sent that link, someone messaged us back, yes, thank you. If I don't get to it tonight, it'll be inspiring me first thing tomorrow morning. You and Unseated are going to be a major, are going to be major resources for me on my journey. I can't say thank you enough. And so those are like the kinds of like things that we get. We don't get feedback very often, but for the most part, it's like very positive feedback. And so that's something that I'm very proud of that we've been doing since we started broadcasting this season.
This is the station tour that we put together while we were facilitating one of the youth workshops and the station tour, just to have another resource to be able to bring out to some of the high school classrooms or even the classrooms on campus. Thank you.
CICR organization is located in the UBCS.
That's right, Beth. And if you miss the show, don't worry, catch our podcast on the Unceded Fairways webpage. On behalf of the Indigenous Collective, thanks for stopping by.